The situation, well, night is falling now. It's getting very dark. If you don't have a generator, then there's no electricity. We're not sure if it will come back later on. It only stays on for a few hours now. People are very apprehensive. There were many airstrikes in the night. The Islamic University was hit again. And the Israeli government has been saying that this is like a Hamas stronghold. But actually, it's one of the best universities in the Gaza Strip. And people, students of all different political opinions and persuasions, study there. And it's a real loss that it's been destroyed. And I was there yesterday walking around the ruins, and it was absolutely shocking. There's just a pile of rubble, and it was really a place of great pride and education. And also the dock was bombed again. And horrifically, this morning at about 9 o'clock in the morning, we were interviewing a family that had their home destroyed through flying bricks, rubble, shrapnel from an attack on the Beit Hanun police station and PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP community center and headquarters. That was destroyed, and it destroyed homes next to it because so much rubble and glass fell in that ceilings were damaged, that really if people had been sleeping there, they would have been killed. Probably could have been well killed. There was one huge block of rock that had come through into one bedroom. But what was really shocking was when we were interviewing this family, there was the sound of two missiles striking, two missile strikes shot from an F-16 airplane. So we waited at the hospital to see what was happening, and three children were brought into the hospital on the back of a cart with a donkey. They didn't come by car, they came by a donkey-led cart. And one of the girls, age 12, Haya was her name, she's dead on arrival. Lima, who's 4 years old, died in front of us at the hospital. The doctors couldn't resuscitate her. And the young boy, Ismail, he's 9 years old and he survived. But they were taking trash to the dustbin. They'd been told by the mother to go and put out the rubbish. And they were struck by two missiles from an Apache. It wasn't a direct hit, but it was very close to where they were. And they had multiple fractures, multiple internal injuries, and they didn't make it. And it's really, really horrific to think of these young girls being struck down. And there was there didn't appear to be any kind of target. It was just an open area. And the damage that it left, apart from taking these two lives, was also it downed a power line and broke a water pipeline as well. The water was rushing into a kind of pond or lake even, that this crate that had been caused by this bomb attack. And all day there's been the sound of, or all morning, actually since this afternoon I've been in Gaza City and we haven't heard any bombs falling. But there were bombs falling last night, and also hear the sound of missile attacks inside the Jabalia camp. And also we could hear the sound of, what we thought was the sound of missiles coming from the other side as well, from the Palestinian side. So the situation is escalating. But it's worth bearing in mind that even though Israel says that it's not targeting civilians, when you use warplanes in a densely populated area like the Gaza Strip, you are going to be killing civilians. Even in areas that were wide open, like the one that we went to today in Beit Hanun, children were killed. And to target also the democratically elected authority of Hamas, you know, people voted this government into power, and it's a social movement as well. It has deep roots in the community. It has deep roots in the mosques, which is one of the reasons that Israel is targeting mosques. And it's unacceptable. It's not any way to deal with serious political contradictions, to try and just use military force to wipe out those contradictions. I don't think that Israel certainly can't be militarily defeated, not by Hamas, not by Hezbollah. I don't think defeat is even the aim here. Really, what people talk about from top to bottom is that they want their human rights, they want to live in peace, they want to have security, and they want the respect. They want Israel to respect international law, the Geneva Conventions, the Hague Regulations, and the UN resolutions, including the Palestinian right of return, and also the International Criminal Court's ruling on the illegality of the apartheid wall. So there are many sides to this issue. It's not a straightforward one, as Israel tries to say it is, with Hamas being a terror organization, and then in this way Israel justifies killing police officers. These police officers are public servants, and they're employed by the Hamas authority. It doesn't make them Hamas resistance fighters. It doesn't make them people who are firing rockets. They are public servants, and they're doing a job, and it happens to be for the Hamas authority. So really, the level of killing here has shocked people, and people are expecting a ground invasion in Beit Hanun, and the house we stayed in had been occupied before by soldiers who'd set up sniper positions. And in another house as well, the same situation. The family said every time Beit Hanun is invaded, they have soldiers occupy their house. And it can be very, very stressful because they're killing people, shooting at them from the windows. And the whole family is put into a room on its own. And if there is a lift in the curfew, they're not allowed out. So it's a really terrible time here. Everyone is very vulnerable. No one feels safe. I don't feel safe. There's no way of being safe. And, you know, the danger comes from, obviously, if you're a target, you're in incredible danger. But also, if you happen to be walking past a building, if you happen to be anywhere where a missile strikes, and you can't even hear it coming, you just hear the impact. You can't see it, you just hear the impact. Then you can die. You can be hit by shrapnel and glass and debris.
We could see that Ship Dignity from Free Gaza Movement wasn't able to, from the media, that the ship wasn't able to come to approach Gaza. Are there any other humanitarian routes? And probably the humanitarian, the status of the population, humanitarian, is worsening.
It is. It was already at a very critical level, and now it is getting worse. We have been hearing that there have been attempts to bring in more aid, but it's not evident here. The bread queues are still just as long as they were a few days ago. There's still no cooking gas. People are using kerosene and very primitive kind of mud ovens. So, and also the hospitals are lacking even basic supplies like gauze, like alcohol, like antibiotics, and we haven't seen any relief in that respect. Some patients have been allowed to go to Egypt. We saw that in Shifa Hospital today. But really, it's still very sensitive. And as far as I know, there's still been no allowance for spare parts for the generators to come in that the hospitals rely upon. So if a generator breaks, there's no way of getting it working again. And in the situation of constant power cuts, that's your patients who are on life support machines dead.
Okay, can we draw a comparison between the Warsaw Ghetto and today's Gaza, especially after the attacks?
I've heard that comparison before. I think there are many similarities, definitely. And maybe what we'll see if Israel invades will be very, very reminiscent of the Warsaw Ghetto. At the moment, we don't have Israeli soldiers inside Gaza. If they come in, and then you're going to see pitched battles and resistance fighting, as well as aerial bombardment, as well as a siege and people not being able to leave and being imprisoned as they are at the moment, then, yeah, I think that is a very telling comparison. And also one of the parallels is that the world is not helping in with the Warsaw Ghetto and the Warsaw Uprising. The Polish leadership, Polish fighters were appealing desperately for supplies, for support, and they had very, very little military support given to them by the US, and Russia stood by and did nothing. And the people were crushed in favor of a higher political goal for a redrawing of the map of Europe between political powers. And there is this higher goal by Israel to redraw the map of Palestine. They've already been doing it since 1948 with the help of the British initially. And in this situation, in 1944 in Poland, many people died, many lost their lives, and they were fighting against one of the biggest superpowers with guns, with rocks, and everybody was involved as well. And maybe this will be the third intifada if people here feel so collectively abandoned and so collectively violated and that the world doesn't care. And people say all we have is God. No one is looking out for us apart from God. Then maybe there will be this third intifada, and people shouldn't have to sacrifice their lives in this way. And it's frightening because I was in Jenin and Nablus in 2002. I saw some of the worst situations, not the massacre in April 2002, but the way that people were afterwards and how they'd been broken and how some of the strongest and best fighters, people, community organizers had been taken away, had been either killed or imprisoned. And even people who were not military fighters but were doing prisoner support work, for example, were imprisoned. And Israel is jailing 10,700 prisoners, political prisoners. Now, if Israel invades and they intend to subdue the population by killing them and also dismantle Hamas, which will uproot so many lives because they're quite rooted in the community and in the society here, it will be a massacre. It will be a disaster. It will be a huge violation of not just human rights, but a whole generation and, you know, more than one generation of people here. And you know, I feel desperate being here because I don't know what it's going to take for the world to wake up and realize that there's something really, really, an atrocity is happening here. And if we don't stop it, it will set the Middle East on fire and it will result in so much death and destruction and in much death and destruction in Israel as well. You know, this level of violence is not in anybody's interest. And people in the Israeli government and the American government and the architects of this attack and those who are complicit with it are kidding themselves if they think that their political goal can be reached by killing people. This is not, you know, occupations against an entire population that is resisting the occupation do not succeed.
A problem is probably also that a majority of Israeli people supports these attacks.
Yes. Shocking, but history teaches us that when states go on the offensive in some of the most drastic ways, there can be parallels drawn with the Second World War, also parallels drawn with Russia and the Chechen conflict. Then with a combination of the media and the media being on the government side or controlled by the media, and also economic insecurity, as Israel does have as well, and also coupled with the fact that every Israeli has to be in the army, is conscripted into the army, so faces a period of service in the occupied territories, and obviously fears this because it's very distressing. These soldiers do come under attack, and many of them, their fathers will have served in the army, their brothers will have served in the army, so this sort of militaristic rhetoric and rhetoric of defense and protection as well that has been the bedrock of Israeli domestic population control or population influence is having a big effect on the way people think in Israel and the way they feel vulnerable and what they believe will make them strong. And it's very much rooted in the military, militaristic language. Many of Israel's presidents have been, or prime ministers have been, military commanders, Sharon being a really clear example. And this is a big problem. You have a militarized society and they see solutions in a militaristic way. So it doesn't surprise me that they support this kind of polarized, kind of extreme approach to dealing with Hamas. And yes, this is a very old conflict and some very negative representations on both sides are entrenched in people's minds. You know, many people here who don't draw a distinction. Many do, I would say more do, but there isn't much of a distinction between Israelis and soldiers. And that's understandable given that many people, the only Israelis they see, or the new generation at least, has been soldiers. Gaza is a bit different actually because there were people who were working in Israel and certainly the older generation had good relations with Israeli businessmen. But that's all been totally bombed, really being undermined. So the way to change this is to build relationships, is to end the siege, is to open the borders, is to be serious about some of the justice-based solutions to this war. And that's, you know, Israel has to abide by international law and recognize that it's not above the law, and that people are going to have to accept a coexistence with their Muslim, Arab brothers and sisters in as one country. I think the only solution is going to be a one-state solution. Small number of people are talking about this. It's not a very popular concept, but I think it's probably the most realistic one, even if it's the hardest one and will take the most work and the most effort and probably the most international mediation and restraint and development. But the two kind of nations and cultures are very intertwined and very interdependent. So, you know, I think there is a way forward. It's just the people of good conscience and political awareness who live in Israel, including the 1948 Palestinians, they have a big role to play in trying to bring about this kind of solution.
What is Free Gaza doing, an organization Free Gaza doing in Gaza, and especially you?
Me, my job is to coordinate delegations and also orientate international activists as well and support their work here. And really, since I got here, it's just been about building relationships with civil society and local NGOs and trying to support them and empower social people on in communities and societies, ordinary people, to be able to advocate for their human rights, but also to build relationships with their fellow Palestinians inside 1948 Palestine and the West Bank, and refugees on the outside as well. We're very much about a kind of unity position, and we don't take any political party side. You know, we don't support any of the political parties. We respect them all. But we are working with civil society at a grassroots level, and we want to break the siege, and we want to bring as much attention as possible to the situation here, the humanitarian situation, and how the situation has been politically created. So we're a mixture of kind of human rights observers, social support, and we accompany journalists and emergency services and clinics, and also we report on what's happening.